Case number 26-1027, California Department of Motor Vehicles Petitioner versus United States Department of Transportation et al. Ms. Kito for the petitioner, Mr. Jerome for the response.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Deputy Attorney General Kristen Kito for petitioner, California Department of Motor Vehicles. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please. The final determination must be vacated because it is contrary to law and arbitrary and capricious. FMCSA's final determination cites just one basis for its decision to withhold $160 million of highway funding from California: that DMV had not canceled approximately 20,000 licenses with expiration dates that exceeded the date on the driver's legal presence documentation. But no federal law required those cancellations. All of the licenses at issue complied with federal law. So FMCSA argues in the alternative that it does not matter whether federal law required those licenses to be canceled, because DMV purportedly agreed to cancel those licenses by January 5th and then unilaterally changed the cancellation date. But this argument is incorrect for at least three reasons. First, the rule that FMCSA relies on to make this argument, which is that the parties have to adhere to a mutually agreed upon schedule for corrective action, requires that there be some underlying violation of federal law that needs corrective action. But here there is none, so the scheduling requirement does not come into play. Second, there was no agreement with FMCSA to cancel these licenses. What there was a series of exchanges. And in each of those exchanges, DMV said that it was under no obligations to FMCSA to act on those licenses because they all complied with federal law. And even if the exchanges can be read as an agreement, then that agreement would have been to cancel and reissue the licenses per FMCSA's express instruction to do so. California did not agree to revoke the driving privileges of those eligible drivers. Finally,
there's an exchange in the emails, which certainly seems to reflect an agreement. It told you needed to provide notice in writing for making a change from the agreement, and you provided the notice.
Yes, that's correct. We did provide notice to FMCSA that the cancellation date would be changing. But, Your Honor, we would not characterize that as an agreement with FMCSA. What happened was that
there were a lot of instances prior to that in which the agency, I'll call it, referred to an agreement and being the agreement being critical and so on and so forth. No objection anywhere from you that there was no agreement.
Your Honor, there are references in the record of DMV being very explicit that with regard to those licenses, there was no obligation to FMCSA. We can point you to a couple of instances of that.
At what point is that? What time?
So on JA032.
You know, where in the sequence of events, what month, year, or month, I should say?
So we are explicit about that, both in the October 10th response to FMCSA's preliminary determination.
What does it say?
On JA32 and JA34, and also in the December 10th response to
FMCSA. Okay, wait a minute, 32 and 34?
Yes. Let's go there.
Okay, we're on 32.
On 32, let me find it for you. Where DMV says any CDL issued with an expiration date that exceeds the person's legal presence would be inconsistent with California law, not a violation of federal law.
Now, where is it that you say there's no agreement?
Well, where it says that therefore it is not a basis for withholding federal funding.
And where on the page is this? I'm sorry. 32, where on the page?
Right at the top of the page in the first paragraph, at the very bottom of the first paragraph. So it's not a basis.
Why does that reflect that there's no agreement about the dates in which you're going to perform the required changes.
What DMV is trying to articulate here is that since there is no violation of federal law, that it is not obligated to do anything with respect to those licenses.
The question is whether you agreed that you would take certain actions by a date certain and then unilaterally change that.
Right. So our position is that DMV did not agree. However, if the court is inclined to see those as an agreement.
I understand that that's your position. What I'm asking is when the agency then says you broke the agreement, you say there's no agreement all along the way. They've been saying there is. Where along the way did you say there's no agreement? You're saying you disagree about what the law required, but not about what you were going to do.
Well, I think that those two issues, Your Honor, are intertwined because the only reason that DMV was providing any information about this action to FMCSA is because FMCSA explicitly requested information about what DMV was doing with respect to those licenses.
The statute makes quite emphatic the necessity to agree to a mutual schedule and to get it done. And you departed from that. That's the argument, right?
That is FMCSA's argument, yes.
You're saying there's no agreement because you had a reservation about what the law required, but you're not saying you didn't agree to do it.
Well, I think the focus, Your Honor, is on that word agree rather than on the action, rather than on the action to cancel the licenses. We cannot agree to do something with the agency if we don't agree that those actions are necessary.
Yeah, you can. You see, well, okay, it's not necessary, but we agree to do it. Simple as that.
Well, I think that there's a difference in the way that DMV treated the certain actions that FMCSA did request from DMV, to which DMV agreed that it would come into compliance with FMCSA's interpretation of the law, despite a disagreement about the interpretation of law.
That wouldn't be very binding. We will come into compliance with the law. Here, the question is whether you've made an agreement to do something specific on a date certain.
Right. So what I'm trying to point to, Your Honor, is in the December 10th letter, where DMV also disagrees with FMCSA's interpretation of the requirements as to issuing non-domiciled CDLs to citizens of Mexico and Canada. And in our December 10th letter, we again reiterate a disagreement with respect to those issuances, but we explicitly state on JA056, DMV intends to come into compliance with FMCSA's current interpretation of the rules. So that, because we agree to come into compliance with FMCSA's current interpretation of the rules, can be construed as an agreement to cancel those licenses issued to citizens of Canada and Mexico. But in the very same document, the very same letter from December 10th, DMV still insists that there is no obligation to cancel those licenses under federal law with respect to those that have extended expiration dates.
You're making the same point that you've made already. Drawback that it has, for better or for worse.
Yes, Your Honor, for better or for worse, correct. That I'm just only pointing out that there were instances where DMV did agree to cease issuing temporary licenses, to stop issuing licenses to citizens of Mexico and Canada. And then there are issues in the record that reflect where DMV did not agree, specifically with respect to the expiration date issue.
What about on the expiration date issue on JA35? This is that same October 26th letter from California DMV. It makes the argument, very top of the page, that the expiration date issue doesn't render licenses issued under the regulations invalid. Nonetheless, DMV will continue to analyze the remaining records and take action accordingly. It sounds like they're saying, again, sort of, under protest, nonetheless, we're going to take the action that you're expecting.
I think that sentence, Your Honor, is referencing to the fact that, one, on October 26th, FMC or DMV had not yet completed its internal audit. That did not complete until later in November. So it was still analyzing. It was still open to the possibility that there were licenses out there that may not comply with federal law. And under that, those circumstances, it would be willing to take action and correct those licenses or cancel those licenses and reissue them as necessary. However, with respect to the expiration date issue, I don't think that we can read that as an express agreement that we will cancel expiration date issues, despite DMV's repeated and consistent emphasis that those licenses do not violate federal law. And the reason that I'm sort of belaboring this point, Your Honors, is because if we look at the plain language of the regulations concerning the expiration date, or I'm sorry, concerning the requirement to adhere to a mutually agreed upon schedule, that requirement only has meaning if there is an underlying violation of federal law. The expiration date require, or I'm sorry, I keep saying that, the requirement to adhere to a mutually agreed upon schedule is found in the regulations part 384, subsection C. Subsection C describes what the agency and a state agency must do when a violation of federal law has already been held or has already been found. And in this instance, there was no violation of federal law.
So you're assuming that you're right about what the regulation means. Assume for the moment that you're wrong.
Sure.
I think that's where a lot of these questions are coming from. Assume that that the agency is correct, that these were overlong CDLs, and you effectively responded, we don't agree there's a violation, but we will fix it to avoid regulatory penalties, and we'll do it by January 5th.
Sure. So assuming that FMCSA is correct about—
And can't they hold the fact, if you did in fact depart from that January 5th deadline, can't they hold that against you?
Sure. So let's assume, as Your Honor has suggested, that FMCSA is correct about the law. Then under those circumstances, what we're talking about here is a 60-day delay in canceling those licenses. So despite the—
You might have had a very good argument that 4% is not warranted for that reason, but you didn't make that argument. So your argument is, it seems to rise and fall almost entirely on what the regulatory interpretation is. If you're right, and there was no requirement, then we might be inclined to think that they can't penalize you for departing from a schedule if you were in fact correct.
Right.
But if you're in fact incorrect.
Right.
So it seems like we actually need to get to this regulatory interpretation question, right?
Yes, I would like to get to that. But first, let me answer your question about whether the case does rise and fall with that question. But if FMCSA is correct about what the regulations say, then the final determination should still be vacated because a 60-day delay in correcting those licenses, even if they needed to be corrected, does not put DMV in substantial noncompliance with the law. Substantial noncompliance is based on the demonstrable combined effects of the state's laws and procedures.
Is that argument in your brief? It may have been a very good argument. It's not in your brief.
Is it not in our brief, Your Honor? I believe we cite to section 384.301 in the definition of substantial noncompliance in our brief.
It would be helpful if you could tell us where in your brief you argued that even if they're right about everything else, you're not in substantial noncompliance.
Well, Your Honor, I won't take the time to look for that specific citation here, but I will assert now that that is the definition of substantial noncompliance, and a 60-day delay would not put DMV in substantial noncompliance based on the combined demonstrative effects of its laws and procedures.
Point that out when you have rebuttal time.
I will look for that, Your Honor, yes, and I'll bring that up to you.
Can I ask you about this issue of the pause?
Yes.
So sounds like the way the parties are debating this is as if there is, in fact, an order, an enforceable order of some kind in place right now that you cannot take action on these licenses. Is that?
That's correct. Yes. Yes, that's correct.
Do you dispute that they could ask you, sternly ask you, because it's backed up by the threat of decertification or a 4% penalty or maybe an 8% penalty now? They could ask you to pause, and just like with any other corrective action, you could choose to comply voluntarily or not. And if you choose not to, you just face the potential that you're wrong and that they do have authority to require that. Is that all correct?
I think that that characterization is correct, Your Honor. And DMV.
So why do you think you're under an order right now?
Because the threat of decertification for failure to comply with this request or order or demand or however you want to characterize it is so extreme that DMV is not willing to take that risk. Decertification would mean that no licenses could be issued in California for commercial driving. And that would be an extreme imposition and extreme deprivation of the ability of California citizens to obtain gainful employment in the commercial driving industry. So that was not a risk we were willing to take.
But that's the situation you're under now with the indefinite pause.
We're under the indefinite pause as to non-domicile commercial licenses. That is not to undermine the extreme consequences of that pause, but to decertify the state entirely would apply to all commercial licenses. So it would be even greater. And we do assert that that pause is ultra-virus because FMCSA does not have the authority to institute a pre-enforcement, never-ending pause, particularly one that not only prohibits DMV from issuing new licenses, but also prohibits DMV from correcting or replacing valid unexpired licenses.
And what's the site for that? Because it seemed like... And this is, I think, clearest in the amicus brief from the SICK drivers, that they were saying you're in a kind of a catch-22 situation.
Yes.
Because there's an obligation to promptly replace the CDLs on which the expiration date of work authorization is earlier than the expiration date of the CDL, and yet California can't swap out a non-conforming CDL with a conforming one, given the pause on the issuance of ND CDLs.
Yes.
Was it the contemplation of California that the 60-day period announced in the letters would allow it to reissue those CDLs during that period?
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. Yes. And as we cited in the notice to those drivers, the cancellation notice was issued under the provision as cited by the amicus brief of California law that requires that immediate ability to apply for a new license. The 60-day window was given with the understanding that DMV and FMCSA would come to some sort of resolution of this annual program review and that the pause would be lifted within that time. And that is exactly what we say on the last page of the December 10th letter on JAO 62-63, where DMV says, per your instructions, FMCSA, we will begin reissuing these licenses to people who received cancellation notices so that we can correct the expiration date issue. And FMCSA waits until a day before DMV was going to be reissuing those licenses to say, stop, you may not reissue those licenses.
So is that also connects, and maybe this is what you were already saying, so I just want to clarify, that connects to your argument that there was never a mutually agreed schedule in the relevant sense, right?
Exactly.
You can't agree if you thought that by January 5th you were canceling and reissuing, and then in mid-December, they say, no, you can't reissue. And there was no agreement in the first place.
That's exactly correct, Your Honor. Yes. And that is pursuant to FMCSA's explicit instructions in the preliminary determination, in the conditional determination, which say you must cancel and reissue these licenses. So,
and is the when you said that FMCSA put the kibosh on the plan to promptly reissue, are you referring to the email of December 16th?
Yes, I am. The email of December 16th, where FMCSA says, to be clear, you may not begin reissuing these licenses until we conduct an entire secondary audit, which will not likely happen until after the new year, which puts DMV on high alert to say, wait a minute, now we are not probably not going to be able to reissue these licenses before that January 5th deadline.
It seems like, though, that's already December 16th, so a bunch of the 60 days, three quarters of that period has already passed. Were there reissuances that took place in that period?
No, no reissuance took place within that period.
So they were planning to do all of them in the last 2 weeks of the year?
Yes, and essentially, DMV was still completing the audit that FMCSA had requested of it, and it said in its December 10th letter, we're done with our audit, we've complied with all of your requests, we're prepared to begin resume issuing licenses pursuant to your instructions and the preliminary determination on December 17th. On December 17th, DMV trained its staff on all of the updated interpretations of law, not including expiration dates, the other updated interpretations of law that FMCSA had put forth throughout these discussions, and it was prepared to begin reissuing those licenses. And to be clear, these licenses at issue in the with respect to the cancellation in January, those licenses only had a clerical error with their expiration dates. That was only an error under state law. So those licenses completely comply with federal law. So even if it would, the 2 week margin to correct those licenses would not have been an issue for DMV. In fact, DMV even offered to FMCSA on December 18th that it could correct the expiration date of those licenses on the back end.
What does that mean?
That means that DMV could go into its system and change the expiration date for all of those licenses to comply with whatever version of the law that FMCSA was putting forth without having to issue new licenses in the process. So that was DMV's effort to try to both comply with this pause that FMCSA was now saying it would not lift, at least until well after the new year, but still hasn't lifted.
And where is that reflected in the JA, the notion that it just could be done from central control?
That is in JA070, where DMV says, we discussed this morning, these are procedures for correcting these licenses with mismatched expiration dates. It explains what it can do that would avoid having to, quote unquote, issue a new license to these drivers. And it says, we'll demonstrate that at our 10 o'clock meeting tomorrow. FMCSA cancels that 10 o'clock meeting and never follows up with respect to whether DMV can follow through with this correction procedure.
So you're saying that reissuing the license doesn't entail what that normally suggests, that you run off a new piece of paper or whatever and send it.
Right.
So if all it entails is changing the expiration date in your internal records, how does the driver know that at some point the license is not valid?
Well, DMV could have sent notices to those drivers explaining that their expiration date had been changed. That could have been resolved if FMCSA had actually approved this measure, this
action.
You're saying
that making the internal change is the reissuing, not notifying the drivers, that's not the reissue?
I'm saying that there are two separate actions that DMV could have taken in order to avoid disenfranchising these 20,000 drivers who were fully eligible to drive under federal law. One is that they could have proceeded with the original plan, as stated in their December 10th letter, to cancel and then immediately reissue those licenses with corrected expiration dates, or, as it suggested to DMV, to FMCSA on December 18th, it could have corrected those licenses on the back end. That would have resolved any expiration date issues that FMCSA was worried about, and it also would have avoided any issuance in violation of the pause. But FMCSA said no to all of it. It did not permit DMV to take any action to correct licenses for these individuals who, again, were entitled to drive under federal law. So when DMV was under the impression, pursuant to FMCSA's instruction, that it was supposed to reissue these licenses, and then FMCSA turns around and says, no, and your alternative won't work either, DMV has really no other choice but to cancel or to extend the expiration date to avoid disenfranchising these drivers and to avoid violating a pause that could result in the decertification of DMV's entire CDL program.
So let me go back to the pause for a moment. Where is that memorialized? I'm just thinking about the question of final action. and our jurisdiction.
Sure.
It's just unclear to me what agency action encapsulates or reflects this pause order.
Sure. So our position would be that the preliminary determination on JA01819 is what actually sets the pause and puts the pause in place. DMV did pause as of that point and has been paused since then. And
1819?
Yes, JA01819, yes. In the final pages of the preliminary determination.
So it's in the preliminary determination, but it's not re-mentioned in the final determination.
I'll have to double check and to see if it is actually mentioned again in the final determination. But our understanding is that when an agency action is final, in this case, the final determination, this court does have jurisdiction to review it pursuant to the APA section 704, where you can review antecedent actions that are incorporated by reference into the final determination. And the
I heard you say before that you weren't going to play around with this because regardless of whether it's memorialized, if the federal agency is threatening to withhold funds, you have to take it seriously. But just in terms of whether there even is an order as opposed to a threat or a comment in an email, it's just hard to see if the final determination incorporates, you know, anything that went before. It doesn't mention, it's not, you said, I think you used the phrase incorporate by reference.
It is express, I'll amend that to say that it is expressly incorporated.
And where is that?
Find that for you. Footnote 3 on JA113. Well, expressly referenced by virtue of the footnote, but the footnote itself says incorporated by reference, so.
The preliminary determination and the conditional determination letters are incorporated by reference. So just in a blanket way, but there's not a mention of the pause.
I suppose not, Your Honor. A direct mention of the pause. Well, let me take that back. I'll review it right now. On JA114, it reiterates its, FMCSA reiterates its demands from the preliminary determination and once again repeats immediately pause issuing non-domiciled CDLs and CLPs. So we can take it from there instead.
So can I, to go back to a version of my question about the pause?
Yes.
What, in your view, has the agency currently penalized you for? Because I thought it was the agency has penalized you for departing from a mutually agreed schedule to cancel overlong licenses. Full stop, that's it. They haven't yet penalized you for departing from a pause because you have not done so in meaningful respect.
I suppose.
And so the yes. question of whether they can punish you for departing, for not implementing a pause, would seem is not presented in this case. It's not right. It may happen in the future. You're kind of seeking a declaratory judgment in advance of when they've actually decided to take that action.
I think I would push back on that characterization, Your Honor, because the facts on the ground are that DMV has not been able to transact any transactions on non-domiciled licenses for over a year. So that in and of itself is already an action that FMCSA or already kind of a penalization that DMV has had to suffer for over a year and that the residents of California have had to suffer for over a year because they cannot get their non-domiciled licenses renewed, replaced, correct, or indeed they're not allowed to apply and to be issued a non-domiciled license. So that pause is in effect. Whether FMCSA has...
This goes back to my initial question, which is, for any required corrective action, can't a state always choose to say, that is not required, we are not going to comply, and if you choose to penalize us for that, we are going to win in court? Now, I fully understand why, from a practical perspective, that is not an appealing position to take.
Yes.
But that is kind of what this, the whole system is. That's how it's all set up.
Yes, I suppose that's correct, Your Honor. But as you say, that's not an appealing position to take. And in the course of all of these discussions, FMCSA made many demands. And so for some of them, DMV said, okay, we'll comply with that. And for others, DMV said, no, we're going to take a hard line. That's going too far. So
I understand this argument. Can I ask you, we haven't actually talked about the regulatory interpretation.
Sure.
Can I just direct you to one piece of the government's argument is that, you know, if an applicant has to present a legal presence document to get the license, it's kind of absurd to think you can issue an 8-year CDL if that document says it's going to expire in a week. And I think that's kind of a centerpiece of their argument. So I'd really like to give you a chance to respond directly to it.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. So I don't think that I'll back up.
Why isn't your reading absurd? Is the short
version. Sure. That is what the law permitted, Your Honor. The law permitted you to have a license that was issued for a maximum period. And what materials...
Why isn't it absurd, given the hypo of the 1 week, that the document's going to expire in a day or a week?
It happens with various kinds of... with various kinds of application conditions. For instance, you also have to prove that you are a resident of the state where you obtain your license. And you could get your commercial CDL in California for 8 years and then tomorrow decide that you're going to move to Arizona. That doesn't invalidate that license. That is simply the way that the law worked. FMCSA decided it didn't like the way that the law worked, so it issued a new final rule or an interim final rule in September and then a final rule in March, changing that the expiration requirements are different, that now a non-domiciled CDL must expire at the same time as its legal presence documentation. Fine. That's a separate question. But prior to September 2025, that is simply how the law worked. And there are other kinds like medical certifications or other things like that that, you know, might expire in the course of a commercial license's validity, but it doesn't also then inherently invalidate the license at the time that those other requirements expire or change. For instance, immigration status also often exceeds the date on the immigration paperwork. So just because a person's, at least up until October 2025, just because a person's employment authorization document expired didn't mean that their authorization to work in the United States also expired. Up until October 2025, that authorization was automatically extended for almost 2 years. So it actually wouldn't make sense to force this person to come in and read up their commercial license when their employment authorization continued. Same for asylum seekers, for instance. So that is why, Your Honor, I don't think that example, although it sort of feels kind of inflammatory, undercuts the plain language of the law, which said CDLs must expire within 8 years of the date of issuance, no exceptions.
And I understand that California had a system of making the CDL expire on the applicant's birth date 5 years after the application. And so if you're going to make it coincide with the expiration of a work authorization, that would have to be something different. Do you have any idea why the policy was to match it with the birth date? Is there any?
I'm afraid I can't speak to that, Your Honor. Yeah, I'm not sure why. I mean, DMV has many different considerations that it has to work through in order to, you know, create its policies and procedures.
There's no problem for California with dialing back the expiration date of a CDL to match the expiration date of the, in fact, it's the state's policy to have those two match.
And correct.
It wouldn't be the birthday preceding the expiration date of the work authorization.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. Yes.
You mentioned when I was asking about where is there a pause order?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned in the final determination, and then I was rereading that and on JA-114, that is just narrating what was set forth in the preliminary determination.
Yes.
I don't think the final determination says, you know, continue the pause. It talked about immediately pausing. And so I'm still just thinking as, and I know this is kind of formalistic, but where where do we look to know that there is an order that is final and reviewable regarding the pause? It seems separate from the final determination. It's a, you know, even if the final determination were deemed to be invalid or arbitrary, the pause stands on its own, does it not?
Well, Your Honor, I think it is reviewable, again, under APA Section 704 as a precedent determination that is incorporated into the final determination.
And it's incorporated in that footnote that says we incorporate everything in.
Yes, yes, yes. And under 704, my understanding is that precedent determinations or precedent agency actions that are not in and of themselves reviewable become reviewable once an agency takes a final action. And the only reason, as we've discussed, that DMV extended the cancellation date, which is the basis for the final determination, is because that pause was in place. And so it could not resume.
Our jurisdiction in this case is based on the Hobbs Act.
Yes.
Not 704. It's based on the Hobbs Act.
Right.
Do you know if that same principle applies under the Hobbs Act, this idea that sort of interlocutory orders are like in district court litigation become reviewable at the end?
You know, Your Honor, I'll be frank. I don't know the answer to that question at the outset. But I would assert that since the pause was in effect and it was a necessary fact that led to the final determination that it is incorporated sufficiently into the final determination to be reviewable as well. So I just want to come back to one point. I'm very aware of my time and I'm of course happy to answer the court's further questions. But if there are, I see there might be one.
Do we have to decide who's right on the regulation about, I mean, the federal government says if the regulation that requires the presentation of a valid work authorization means that the CDL may only be issued for the period of work authorization and you disagree,
mm-hmm.
if the federal FMCSA is correct, then you got no case?
Well, as we've said, if FMCSA is correct about that, then all that we're looking at this point is a 60-day delay in taking that corrective action. And that would not be sufficient for DMV to be in substantial noncompliance with federal law. So we would still...
Which you may or may not have argued.
Correct, correct. So we would still assert that the final determination is arbitrary and capricious under those circumstances, because as we stand here today, all of the licenses have been canceled. So there is really no colorable argument that DMV remains in substantial noncompliance with federal law. We've done everything that FMCSA has demanded, even those things that DMV agreed or disagreed were necessary.
Any questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Rebuttal time.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Jerome.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Simon Jerome for the Department of Transportation. I'll begin with the question of the penalty as differentiated from the pause. I took my friend to say that the final determination cited just one basis for the issuance of the final determination. Later on, my friend cited JA 113 footnote 3, which incorporates the prior grounds stated in the preliminary and conditional determinations by reference, and that in fact disproves the point. The fact is, FMCSA's audit revealed a number of systemic issues that pervaded the process by which the California DMV issues commercial driver's licenses. As the preliminary, conditional, and final determinations note, yes, the centerpiece of the problem was the overlong expiration date. In addition, the DMV issued commercial driver's licenses to categorically ineligible citizens of Canada and Mexico. My friend disagrees that in fact was a violation of federal law in the record, but has not raised that argument again on the petition for review.
So I heard you to say to agree that the delay is the centerpiece of the final determination. And that's certainly my read of it.
Yes, sir.
And we have cases that say, you know, what we have before us is a final order of the agency imposing a 4% penalty. And under our cases, if there is a ground that is invalid, so just assume for the moment that there wasn't a mutually agreed schedule and that the order is wrong for that reason, we could only affirm this if it were clear that you would have issued the same 4% penalty, even if there wasn't a departure from a mutually agreed schedule. So would you agree with me that that's not the case? It is not clear on this record. Maybe you would impose some other penalty in another action, but if we thought there was no departure from a mutually agreed schedule, we have to vacate this order.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. And the reason why is because, as I mentioned a moment ago, the audit is a more holistic process than this myopic focus on the expiration date issue would suggest. As all of us sort of have a layman's understanding with, are interconnected computer systems that, you know, issue, sort of take in a lot of data and are responsible for spitting out a license that's compliant with a variety of laws. The audit process is holistic. And yes, one of the primary sort of things that was in dispute was whether or not FMCSA's interpretation of federal law was correct. And so I'd say that occupies
most of the pages. I understand the argument. What we have to look at is the final determination, right? And when it says explicitly, we have a lot of concerns, primarily the timely rescission of 17,000 documents, right? So
that's right.
What in the final determination suggests that even if that didn't happen, if the primary ground for this determination was absent, we still would have issued it? Because I think that's the question in front of us.
I think there's also, so I disagree because, as Your Honor mentioned, there's the question of the agreement as well. But putting that to the side for just a second, you know, the FMCSA repeats that it needs to go back and audit to make sure the systems are working properly, that it needs to sort of verify compliance at the end of this process. I took my friend to mention how many months it's been. I think part of the cause of the delay is in the DMV's hands. And I would just sort of point, I realize I'm outside the record, but I mean to stress that this regulatory regime functions in such a way that when states are notified by FMCSA that there's a problem, many of those problems are resolved informally. Many other states in this cycle were issued preliminary determinations and have resolved things much more quickly. All of this to say, this suggests that the problem is quite pervasive. And FMCSA quite reasonably said, we want to make sure that the system is operating properly. And yes, you know, you've sort of unilaterally departed from the centerpiece that we reiterated was a big part of our determination. But in addition, we need to make sure that the other steps have been taken.
I'm a little confused by the facts here. The final determination, and this is January 7th, says DMV has failed to undertake the necessary step of rescinding and reissuing non-compliant, non-domiciled CLPs and CDLs as promised and agreed upon. I'm on JA 120. How could the DMV have done that, given that back in December when they said, okay, you know, we're ready now, we've done our training, we're going to reissue compliant CLPs and CDLs, FMCSA said, no, you can't do that. So I just am having trouble understanding on the ground why, you know, how FMCSA was incensed that this hadn't happened when it had expressly said, no, the pause is even for those.
Your Honor, I am looking at the same page at JA 120. I think the sentence that you've quoted
about sentence on the page.
Right. Yeah. So I was looking a little further up in the paragraph, crucial corrective action of rescinding and reissuing. I mean, I think that, you know, I don't read that to be at odds with what the agency had said prior. Unambiguously, as of mid-December in the email exchange that I believe Judge Ginsburg cited with my colleague, that the reissuance was only to take place after FMCSA was satisfied that the audit was completed. I don't dispute that at the outset, it seems in the record that there's some ambiguity, certainly. I think in the preliminary determination, there's a statement that you're going to rescind and reissue. And then in the subsequent bullet, there's reissue only after coming into compliance. And so I agree that, you know, the first evidence we have in the record, the FMCSA, clears up that ambiguity comes in mid-December, in the December 10th email, saying, no, to be absolutely clear, you're not to begin reissuing until...
Can I ask you, when in your view, did the parties come to a mutual agreement that this rescission would occur, that some action would occur on January 5th?
So the earliest date I read the DMV to have agreed to canceling the licenses. So in the response to the preliminary determination, the DMV says we'll take action as necessary.
And the final determination seems to take the position that the conditional determination memorializes that agreement.
That's right.
So the 51.
That's right. The conditional determination followed California's response.
So can I have to ask about JA 51. This is the conditional determination.
Sure.
At this point, California has conveyed, we plan to do this by January 5th. And in this document, the agency says timely rescission is important. On the middle of this page, the agency then says, please give us some additional information, including the approximate date by which the rescission will be completed. So this is the document that supposedly memorializes a mutually agreed upon schedule. And it looks like the agency is asking, so what should the schedule be? And that's a little difficult for me to square.
I take that to be, I think this comes back, Your Honor, to the fact that the cancellation was scheduled to happen in two batches. And so the total number of non-compliant licenses numbered approximately 21,000.
I understand all of that, that none of that appears here, right? Actually, the date January 5th doesn't appear here. It says, please do this timely. Let us know when you will do it. It does not say, we accept your agreement to rescind 17,100 on January 5th, and we want to know when the second tranche will be canceled. It just says, we reiterate the importance of timeliness, and please let us know a proposed schedule.
So, you know, I take this to, I take the conditional determination to have rested in large part as well on conversations that the agency had. I recognize that that's not in the conditional determination, but it certainly seems that the agency has stressed the importance of adhering to the schedule. In addition, in the response California sent on December 10th, it sort of makes clear the dates on which that will take place. So I think there can be little question that there was an unambiguous agreement before the unilateral departure.
So I appreciate that. So assume that's right. And I take it this might have been what Judge Pillard's questions were driving at. Assume there was an agreement in mid-November. But one side thinks, but there's no agreement on what. And in fact, California thinks it's agreed to rescind and reissue. And then in December, the agency comes in and says, no, you just have to cancel. You cannot reissue. So there hasn't been, you know, a meeting of the minds on what's going to occur. Isn't that kind of a problem for saying there's a mutual agreement?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because I think there's agreement on the first part. There's agreement to rescind. And I mean, putting aside whether there was I take that to be the DMV saying, well, we thought we would be able to do something we weren't able to do, which to my earlier point, I think certainly at the outset there was some ambiguity, but I think that was resolved before the point California said, never mind, on Christmas Eve, we're sending this email and saying we're pushing this back by a further 60 days.
But they're also under a state court order to do the thing that they thought that under Judge Garcia's rubric, they might have thought they were agreeing to the extent they agreed, which is that they're going to rescind and reissue. And they're ordered to do that.
I do take that to be, with my limited familiarity with the state court case, I do take that to be the obligation, Judge Pillard. I think we agree. I think, you know, what's sort of curious to me is when we look again at the timeline, we have, I'm going to say the first time in the record to sort of distinguish from what might have been conveyed to the DMV externally, because I stress this is not sort of only the exchange of letters. This is a lot of consultation going back and forth between FMCSA and DMV at this time. But on December 16th, JA67, FMCSA makes abundantly clear you cannot begin reissuing licenses until we've signed off. There's a subsequent email on JA71 from DMV to FMCSA where I don't read them to say, you know, hold on, you know, this is a huge concern. And certainly California has now said this is, you know, we just, this was absolutely a crucial condition.
That next site, so you said December 16th, JA 67,
and then
FMCSA, and then?
And then 2 days later, in the response that FMCSA, JA 71, Your Honor. There's an email from DMV to FMCSA. Thank you for the productive call. Here are our plans. Here's training material. You know, there's no sort of, you would expect if this were an issue, sort of, you know, I'm struggling to recall principles of contract law that I learned a long time ago and have mostly forgotten. But if there is a central element of the bargain, I just recall there being sort of, if there's something, you know, when you're seeking damages, when you want to say the other side has erred in some way, and there's this crucial background assumption that you've never made clear, whether that's the state court order, forgive me, Your Honor, I don't recall the date the California court ordered DMV to begin reissuing the canceled licenses. But, you know, if there's this thing that you absolutely must do and it doesn't come up even in the next communication that you've had, and it doesn't come up until several days later, approaching the holiday season, that you say, well, now unilaterally, we're just going to push this. I mean, I don't think that that is a reasonable response to what seems at most to be resolving ambiguity that I stress again, may have been cleared up earlier.
You may have already said this, but can you just pin down for me where you think the clearest evidence is that California agreed to a specific deadline and what it agreed to?
In the response, the December 10th response, I believe, I'm sorry, if you give me just a moment, Your Honor, because there was the email that California sent on November 6th. I'm looking at JA 37. It refers to an attachment that appears on JA 40. And on November 6th is the date California said, we're sending these notices of cancellation and they will be effective in 60 days. I take that to be, here is what you've asked for and here is the timeline. Judge Garcia, I'm afraid.
The next question is, where does the agency say, fantastic, we agree and we'll hold you to that?
So in the conditional determination that subsequently
the one that asked, when are you going to do it? I'm sorry.
I think there could have been some inartful drafting there, Your Honor. I think what is abundantly clear is on November 6th, the DMV says, here's what we're doing and here's the timeline. And several days later, a week later, the agency says, remember, timeliness is super important. Again, I think I wish this were explained more clearly. I think it can be explained. A reasonable reading would say there are two batches. There's sort of this big batch of 17,000, and then there's a subsequent batch that is to be canceled later. I think that it makes a good deal of sense to read it that way. But I agree with you that that's not as clear as it could be in the record.
All this time, California is clearly saying, we're doing this because we think California law requires it. FYI, we sent these letters out. We're reviewing this. We're working on our systems. To take that to be a commitment is a bit of a stretch. And then especially when you have, or I'm looking for your response to whether that's a bit of a stretch, and where on page JA 51, where FMCSA says, tell us when this is all going to be done, and in SIDLIS, it's a little hard to see it as meeting of the minds. Is there more where you feel like this meeting of the minds is crystallized?
I would say what there's a meeting of the minds on is the timeline for cancellation of the first batch. I mean, I stress again, I think this is a theme I began with, that this is an integrated process meant to deal with many aspects of a sort of challenging technological problem. If you'd bear with me for just a second, I think it's important to stress, California agrees that fully one-third, 31%, close to one-third of the licenses issued were issued in violation of state law. That suggests a large problem. This is not sort of a one-off thing that you had in one branch of the DMV. This is a systemic issue. And so the agency is saying, we are really concerned about this cancellation aspect, and you've agreed to this timeline, and we're going to stress that that's important. In addition, we're going to be making sure that you've satisfied the other things that we told you we were worried about. The rescission of licenses issued inappropriately to citizens of Mexico and Canada. The correction of the practice that California has not disputed, either in the papers here before the court or in the record, of issuing temporary licenses with
route. Now, hasn't that stopped?
I take it to be that that practice has stopped, yes,
and the California, I mean, and the Canada-Mexico issuances have been taken care of also.
I understand that to be what the DMV has represented, and I don't understand from my client that we have a different view. But again, to sort of stress the point about the—
And on the mismatched expiration dates, the samples that are in the record show many times where the document that was presented had a sooner expiration date than the CDL that was issued. But then later, the work authorization was renewed. So, you're characterizing this as very serious and pervasive. California's characterizing this as technical. And I'm trying to get a handle on which it is. And to the extent, like when I first saw this case, I thought, oh, wow, a lot of people who have no work authorization are driving. And I don't see evidence of that, actually, in this record. I see potential future problems of that, but not in a way that it has to be dealt with in 60 days. It seems like I don't see examples of people who lack work authorization and are actually using a CDL.
So, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record that I'm familiar with that shows as of the date the petition was filed. You know, sort of at present, there are individuals driving with expired credentials. I take the point to be primarily you have issued credentials where there's a mismatch. I think, Your Honor, something can be both technical when it comes to the issuance of driver's licenses, which are a self-executing credential. I think something can be both technical and severe and pervasive. It can be a problem that the FMCSA legitimately wants to see remedied. And I stress here that, you know, the FMCSA stands by its position that the licenses were overlong in violation of federal law. But beyond that, the interest in remedying that problem, in remedying California's ability to issue licenses that it can verify comply with some form of law, I think is quite strong. I think it is absolutely reasonable to say, you've told us you're going to do this on this timeline. Recall that this had dragged out for months already.
FMCSA can penalize a state agency for not complying with state law.
I wouldn't go that far, Your Honor. I mean, I don't think that you need to say that here. I think the agreement really on these facts is what I would rest on. The fact that California agreed that the licenses needed to be canceled and then later said, you know, it acknowledged its obligation to get, you know, agreement to deviate from that in writing and then said anyway, the day before Christmas.
So this sounds, we haven't talked about the regulatory interpretation yet.
Sure.
But it sounds like part of your argument, certainly in your brief, is even if we're wrong about the regulatory interpretation, we can still penalize them for departing from a mutually agreed schedule.
Yes, sir.
And I guess I'm struggling with that for the following reason. I guess the shortest version would be that places them in a worse position than a state that just said, we disagree. We are not taking your corrective action. And then they come to court and convince us they're right.
I think I'd come back to the facts of this case where when the violation, where the dispute is about whether it's a violation of federal law, but it's agreed it's a violation of state law, California, I presume, would not back away from its interest in adhering to state law. I'm not saying that you need to say that the FMC.
And they still haven't. I mean, they said we need a little bit longer. And they are doing, apparently, and have done an overhaul of their state system because state law says the CDL expiration date and the work authorization expiration date need to match. They didn't have that working and they want to get that working. And it's unclear why the punitive attitude, if there aren't people who are actually driving without work authorization, and if over the Christmas and New Year's period, the state said, and the state anticipated that it would swap them out,
right,
whereas all FMCSA is interested in is the cancellations, there's some further discussion to be had, but instead the guillotine drops and the final determination is made. It's just help me out in understanding why, as a matter of federal-state cooperation, that makes sense in achieving the joint goals of FMCSA and California DMV.
I think the reason it makes sense, Your Honor, is because I would direct you to the same regulation the court cited in denying a stay in this case, 49 CFR 384.307, subsection D, which explicitly says the FMCSA will take into account the mutually agreed schedule. I think that that is a textual recognition of A, the importance of timeliness, and B, the importance of federal-state cooperation. I think, as I mentioned a few moments ago, this system is sort of built on a structure of cooperation. It assumes robust cooperation between state agencies and the federal agency. And when you have an instance like we saw here, where on very short notice during the holiday season, the DMV took a unilateral step to say, we've been cooperating, we've been making progress, and no more, we're done. We're taking our ball and we're going home. I think that that is sort of justified.
They said, we need more time to do the work. They're continuing to do the work. They're not taking a ball and going home and saying, forget it, we'll let these mismatched CDLs persist. That's not what I see from the record.
If I could change the metaphor a little bit, maybe not taking the ball and going home, but taking the ball
and time.
That's right. But I think
6 days, I can tell you, we're not going to be able to do this. It's over the holiday. That, you know, maybe that cuts in their favor because they have people have to having to work. Maybe it cuts in your favor because you don't really respond promptly to that. But you know, it's a time of year when people are taking a breath and they're realizing they can't get it done for two reasons. One, maybe it's harder than they thought, but two, they didn't realize that they were paused and they couldn't actually complete the ability to let these people who are legally entitled to their CDLs to have them.
I think I'd come back, Your Honor, to the fact that these interactions are very routine, that states do this every year with FMCSA. And so this is sort of a common pattern.
What, every year?
Undergo the audit, find a range of deficiencies. I think in many states every year this happens and it's expected that they'll fix them. And so.
And do they every year have federal funding cut off?
I don't understand. I mean, I don't know how common it has been. I take it to be in the scope of 50 states. On the rarer side.
I agree. So I'm not sure which way your argument cuts. That yes, they're used to audits and they actually, I mean, it's a productive process. They actually fix problems as a result.
That's right, Your Honor. And I think ultimately, if we're in this world where we're saying, well, should the FMCSA have given the DMV more time? Should the DMV have done this? The question becomes under the APA, is it unreasonable? Is it arbitrary and capricious for the agency to say, no, you said you were going to stick to the schedule after we told you that timeliness was important, after we told you that we wanted these to be rescinded right away. And you nevertheless deviated from that schedule. I do think that's the heart of this case. I would fall back on that standard of review.
And yet it does.
Please.
Depend on who's right about the law.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I'm happy to. I think maybe we should get into the regulatory interpretation.
Well,
but
if you don't have any authority, then it's hard to reconcile the penalty with the departure.
I think, respectfully, Your Honor, I do think they have the authority to say that you've agreed to rescind licenses and then deviate.
No, I'm talking about the authority to insist that the CDLs expire no later than the lawful presence.
I would say, you know, I think there was an agreement to do that for whatever reason, that California subjectively agreed to do it. And so I think that it is within FMCSA's prerogative to say you've deviated from an agreed upon schedule. But on the...
So I understand you're reserving the position, right? but it may be material to the court that whether the department has the authority to insist that the law required this.
Right? Sure. So
it's not really crisply expressed in the statute, is it?
In the relevant regulations, I think. So in the most recent. That's right. In the most recent rulemaking the agency did, which I believe Judge Pillard, you and I will be chatting again on Tuesday about this final rule, the agency made it clearer. So certainly there was room to argue.
It is a little peculiar that actually you brought this to the attention of the court that in 2002, the IG recommended that the agency implement requirements to ensure that only lawfully present drivers have CDLs, and that Congress subsequently mandated this. That was in 2016, I think. In any event, so it nonetheless doesn't get clarified until well into this dispute.
What gets clarified, Your Honor, is that so from from the rulemaking that followed the congressional mandate that FMCSA required that the states verify lawful presence, it has been the case. This was in the 2011 rulemaking that an individual applying for a non-domiciled CDL who is not a U.S. citizen had to present evidence of lawful presence, which the agency interpreted to be an employment authorization, to include employment authorization documents. What was made clearer in the more recent rulemaking is to make, you know, in our position, to make abundantly clear what should have been obvious from the get-go, that an individual can only possess the CDL for such time as they can show that they are lawfully present.
That's the inference you're saying a sentient person would draw, but it's not the requirement itself.
I think, Your Honor, you know, this court has said in case after case, you have to read regulations in their context and with an eye to the purpose they're meant to advance. The unambiguous, in my view, purpose of a regulation requiring demonstration of lawful presence at the moment an individual obtains a CDL is to make sure that when they have that CDL, they are lawfully present. To the hypothetical, I believe we illustrated in our brief, and Judge Garcia, you discussed with my friend, it seems rather absurd that a credential for years and years, 5 years, 8 years, could be issued with a document that expires tomorrow. But that is the import of my friend's interpretation.
So I think that does sound unusual. It sounds like the more normal operation of this would be that you're presented with a document that's going to expire in, say, a year. And I understand this is no longer the case, but for many employment authorization documents until 2025, they would automatically renew. So when you say the license should expire when the document does, you don't know when that document's going to expire. In fact, the default was, for many folks, these are going to be automatically renewed. So it doesn't actually seem that unusual at all that you wouldn't force someone who is going to get an automatic renewal to also come back to the state and say, hey, I got my automatic renewal. Please extend me for one more year. It is a mountain of paperwork.
I agree with Your Honor that that is a sort of valid reason to have the contrary rule that my friend suggests. I disagree that it makes sense to read, that it sort of overcomes the common sense reading that when you show paper.
Well, it's a hard thing to get these legal presence documents in the first instance. And as I just explained, not so hard to extend them. So it would be quite meaningful and address the IG's concerns to make sure that folks had legal presence. I have no idea what the best rule is. I'm just saying it would make some sense and be meaningful to do it at a time of application and not make it sort of this ongoing duty to come back, wouldn't it?
You know, Your Honor, I think I would come back here, if I could, to sort of the way the regulatory regime operates. There are a lot of situations in which this court confronts a regulation and its meaning after a penalty has been imposed with no opportunity to sort of dispute its meaning. Here, I think if you're in a world where you're discussing the agency's, I think, quite common sense approach and says, the agency says, here is the regulatory regime we are responsible for enforcing and we'd like you to come into compliance with that. And the state says, we don't agree that it requires that, but yes, we intend to come into compliance. The question is ultimately, did the agency act unreasonably in saying you were out of compliance when you unilaterally deviated from that? I realize that's a bit long-winded, but that's why I'm saying you can sort of skirt this issue.
You're not suggesting we defer to you on the interpretation of the regulation, though.
No, Your Honor. I mean, I think that, no. But I think that in this, if I could, I'm sorry, Judge Biller, just to say, I think that the regulatory context matters a lot. This is meant to be a cooperative enterprise. And California, any interest California might have in these licenses not being canceled, I think has to take account of the fact that state law prohibits them from being issued on the terms that they were issued. I think in an equitable sense, in sort of a common sense, a reasonableness analysis, let me put it that way, that has to come into play. I'm sorry, Judge Billard, I think you had a question.
I just wanted to ask you questions parallel to what I asked Ms. Kida, which is about the pause and the authority for the pause.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the statutory regulatory authority for it and where is it imposed?
So I would say in the same mouthful of a regulation I mentioned earlier, 384.307. That is the regulation describing what happens after a preliminary determination of noncompliance. Give me just a second. I have it here. So subsection A says the state must cooperate with the review.
This is in addendum.
Oh, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
73.
Program review of state compliance?
Yes, Your Honor.
And it is, you said, 307?
384.307. So I just mentioned subsection A, but subsection C describes corrective action. The state must provide documentation of corrective action as required by the agency. The state's reply must explain what corrective action it either has implemented or intends to implement. You know, I don't think that comes down quite clearly and says there are, you know, explicitly, there are circumstances under which we can tell you to pause CDL issuance. I do think I would come back to a point I've sort of touched on several times, which is this is meant to be a cooperative process. There are scenarios in which you might imagine there's no need for a pause, where FMCSA might say to the state agency, look, we just need you to make sure these extra things are happening, but no need to stop the truck, to use another metaphor.
So you're saying that the authority for the pause is that it's corrective action implemented on a schedule mutually agreed upon by the agency and the state. I mean, I don't think I understand your arguments about California having proffered the letter saying that the non-compliance CDLs would expire as of January 5th. I don't see anywhere in the record where California said, we will pause all issuances of, we're talking about just non-domiciliary CDLs, right?
Correct.
We will pause all issuances of those permits and licenses indefinitely until you're satisfied.
So I would say a couple things. I think, A, I just want to put a pin in the question of final agency action, because I think that is a sort of separate obstacle. But you could view this two ways. I think it is perfectly natural to read a pause to be corrective action. It either has implemented or will implement. Corrective action appears several times in this regulation. I think generically this sort of assumes that FMCSA will provide a list of corrective actions, as happened here. I think separately, you know, I don't think, and this ties into my point about final agency action, I think you could also not look at this regulation and just say, this is a regulatory regime, I think not uncommonly, under which a regulator says, informally, we want you to do this. You need to do this because we want to make sure that you're going to come into compliance. This is sort of a necessary step to come into compliance, and you violate that at your peril, but that there's no, I would say there's no final order under which I dispute, I think fundamentally with my friend, that there is some sort of reviewable final order. I don't think 704 smuggles that in, not because I don't think the principle applies necessarily, but just because I don't think that the agency has ever enforceably said, what it did was issue a final determination withholding funds.
And the final determination doesn't have in it, and you are indefinitely paused in granting NDCDL.
I don't read it to contain that sort of injunction.
So
no,
your view is that there is no pause in effect, or that there is an indefinite pause in effect and it's not reviewable? What's your position?
The position is that there is a pause in effect insofar as I take the DMV not currently to be issuing non-domiciled CDLs, but that is a sort of a matter of common agreement between a regulated party and the regulator.
Right now, the agency has not ordered DMV to do this pause. It has
stated this is a required corrective action.
It has put them on notice that if they don't take that corrective action, the agency will consider penalties in the future.
I think that's the best way to look at
it. But now they're being penalized, so the pause is lifted. They're suffering in a different way.
I don't think the pause has not been lifted because the process of remedying the audit, I think ordinarily, I come back again to sort of the way these things normally work. I don't take it to be the case that it often takes quite as long to finish a process like this. But no, I think the pause in an informal, not an order sense, but just the state of facts on the ground continues because the DMV has not established FMCSA satisfaction that it has remedied the problems that led to the issuance of the preliminary determination in the first place.
The statute you're referring to also gives the state agency the option in responding to what would be the initial determination.
Yes, Your Honor.
That may instead, or alternatively, it says, say why the FMCSA preliminary determination is incorrect.
Yes, Your Honor.
They did that.
They did, and they could have stopped there, but they didn't stop there. They said, we agree, we're going to cancel these because they violate state law. And that there are more than that, I think they described, we've talked a lot about violations of law.
Right, but I mean, the way this scheme's set up, it seems, is on the one hand, there's this directive, you kids can reach an agreement and work it out on a schedule and then adhere to the schedule. And then at the other end, it says, and by the way, if you don't, if the state doesn't, you can really hammer them. So the process of getting to agreement takes place under the this background of a potentially overwhelming penalty. Now you're saying, well, they can, as and this came out earlier as well, they could have said, we disagree and we're not going to comply and go to court.
They could have. And Your Honor, this is exactly what New York did in the Second Circuit.
They don't disagree with everything. But on this on interpretations of the law, they disagree. They didn't disagree that their systems needed upgrading.
That's what I was going to get to, is they say these, what we call violations of federal law, and they agree are violations of law, albeit state law, resulted from pervasive technological problems. They agreed there were problems to be remedied. I think that that is, that sort of undergirds, I think, the legitimacy of a penalty for deviating from a schedule to fix those problems, is that those problems are pervasive in a sort of unified system that affects compliance with state and federal law.
You said they're pervasive, but a bunch of them have been fixed. So we're really focusing on the mismatched expiration dates.
I don't believe it's the case, Your Honor, and I don't take my friends to argue either that they have, that FMCSA should have said already that they are finished. I, you know, the sort of latest I have is that DMV has sent more information to FMCSA, but that FMCSA is reviewing that and remains to date not satisfied that the technological and policy and sort of training policy problems have been fixed. So there is.
I thought you said that it was your understanding that the Canada-Mexico problem and the temporary CDLs without proof of work authorization, that those problems have been fixed. And I, when you said the systemic problems, we're going back to the mismatched.
If I give, I apologize if I gave that impression. I take it to have been DMV's representation to FMCSA that the licenses issued to Canadian and Mexican citizens have been canceled and that they no longer, clerks will no longer issue, perhaps consistent with an overall pause, temporary licenses without reporting those to CIDLIS, to the Commercial Driver License Information System. I do not believe it's the case. I mean, to go back to my point about this being a sort of unified process, that FMCSA is satisfied that all of the problems it identified at the outset are fixed.
Right. I guess I'm just trying to understand. You say that in a kind of open-ended way, but I take it the main problem that hasn't been fixed is the mismatched expiration dates. And that is something that California would like to fix by being able to cancel and reissue so that people who are lawfully entitled to drive and have passed all their safety tests and maintained them and don't have, you know, driving infractions or anything, that those people can continue to work.
I don't
That's their position. Your position is no, cancel them and we'll deal later with their ability to continue to work. And is there something more than that when you refer to systemic, continuing systemic problems?
I'm not totally, I understand Your Honor's question, but I do think that, you know, my understanding of the problems at issue is that it's sort of, you need to make sure that the all of the deficiencies identified have been remedied and that they might interact in such a way that you can't be sure that it's the case that everything is fixed until you've reached the end of the necessary reprogramming, the necessary retraining, verification of those processes. I take these things to be interlinked. Is that, I want to be responsive to Your Honor, but I'm not quite sure.
That's not very clarifying. It's just very general and very vague. I just wonder what the non-compliance, I understand that you need to, you know, check the boxes, that you have the information verifying that they've done what they've said they've done, that you're comfortable with their training and the computer programming is going to give assurances that it's going to continue in the way that they've represented. But in terms of things where there isn't agreement as to what needs to be done and it hasn't happened, the only thing I hear you saying is that the mismatched expiration dates of the work authorization and the CDLs has not, those CDLs have not been canceled.
I'm sorry, I do understand those licenses to have been canceled. I think it is all on the back end, this sort of process of making sure the systems are fixed. I don't dispute that the mismatched licenses have been canceled and that the licenses issued to citizens of Canada and Mexico have been canceled, and that the practice has stopped of issuing temporary licenses. We don't dispute that. I do want to say the question, the action before the court is the issuance of the final determination. And at that point, that was not the case, right? That the licenses had not been canceled as of that date. Neither
counsel today emphasized that the state of the world on January 7th, or whatever date this was issued, was they were going to cancel these in 2 months. And the argument was that shouldn't be regarded as substantial noncompliance. What's your response to that argument?
I, like you, Judge Garcia, did not read sort of that version of the argument to have been made in the briefs. I think that they focused exclusively on the expiration date issue. They say that we should win on this interpretation of federal law and did not, until we mentioned in our responsive brief, did not address the other grounds.
And then I just want to make sure, see if we have a shared understanding of the regulatory scheme along the lines of something Judge Ginsburg was asking. You mentioned New York. Imagine just the state had just said, we disagree. Yes. We are not going to correct. We're not going to take your proposed corrective action. Fine us and we'll seek review. And then they win, right? If the state wins on that petition and a court agrees with them on their interpretation of the regulation, they can't be penalized, right?
I think there are, so in that case, there are other issues I think that we've brought up, but I think
hypothetical, not New York. The follow-up question is, right, say they never engaged, no corrective action is taken.
Right.
They just say, we're right and you're wrong, and a court agrees with them. And the agency says, you were right, but you didn't agree to a mutually agreed schedule to fix this non-problem with us, and so we can still penalize you for that. That can't be, right?
I think it would be an awfully difficult argument, Your Honor. I mean, I can't see the agency doing that.
But what's the difference between that and this case? If we agree with them that there was no problem to fix, why should they be penalized for not sticking to an agreed schedule to fix a non-problem?
Because I think once we move beyond, once you've resolved this contrary to law question, we're in the world of arbitrary and capricious action. And against the backdrop, you have an agency charged with enforcing CDL regulations.
It's the idea that they've agreed that it's a state problem and the agency wants to make sure they're...
And that the problems are real. And so again, I was saying to Judge Ginsburg, we've discussed whether the problems manifest at the level of state law or federal law, but they're real problems.
Well, let me make sure I understand something. In Judge Garcia's hypothetical, if they've said, sorry, we don't agree, and go to court and prevail, you come back and say you still can get them for violating the agreement, but there is no agreement in that hypothetical. So
I think we may have misunderstood each other, Judge Ginsburg. I think you're right. Where the state says there's no agreement, I think it would be a very difficult argument for us that we could validly penalize a state because the question would be, did you substantially non-comply with the affected standard, with the relevant portion of federal CDL law.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
I believe Ms. Cheeto had reserved time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I'm happy to, of course, address any questions that may have come up in the course of conversations with my friend on the other side. But there are a couple of points that I also want to make.
Did you find the argument we spoke about in your brief?
Yes, Your Honor. We will admit that you're correct that the precise argument that we were making today was not explicitly laid out in our briefs. But I want to explain what we do lay out, in our briefs. Our original opening brief was based on the fundamental issue of whether those licenses were required to be canceled. And we understood FMCSA's position at that time to be that because we agreed to cancel licenses that violated federal law, we were required to adhere to a schedule for that corrective action. So that is what our opening brief focuses on. As I think my friend mentioned, it was not until FMCSA made the argument in their responsive brief that
the agreement could be an independent basis for the final determination, separate and apart from any violation of federal law that we then needed to come back in our reply brief and explain that we were in substantial compliance with all of the relevant components of federal law. And we do that on pages 9 to 10 of our reply, where we describe sort of what I was alluding to this morning, the fact that substantial compliance is based, it has a two-part definition. It's based both on, as we discussed, the combined demonstrative effects of the state's laws and procedures, and also specifically on a more technical level, is only based on compliance with subpart B, the substantive standards of the Federal Motor Carrier Safety Administration's laws, subpart B of Part 384. The requirement to adhere to a corrective schedule is not found in subpart B. So a violation of the corrective schedule on its own cannot be an independent basis for the finding of noncompliance.
That seems to be a powerful point. I'd like to just get a little help walking through it.
Sure, absolutely.
Where is the limitation to subpart B?
In regulation 49 CFR 384.301. That is the definition of substantial noncompliance.
Page 70 now.
And this is what we, describe in on pages 9 to 10 of our brief. So page...
Okay. Mm-hmm. I noticed that before, but I didn't trace it through. So,
sure.
And what is it that's not in part subpart B?
The requirement to adhere to a corrective schedule. That is in subpart C. So the way that the requirements are laid out or the regulations are laid out is that subpart B provides the substantive requirements that a state needs to meet in order to be held in substantial compliance. And subpart C tells you what to do. It's the procedures that the agencies have to follow. Once a determination of substantial noncompliance under subpart B has been held, has been found. So if there is no violation under subpart B, which is the case here, then subpart B is frankly irrelevant. It doesn't come into play at all. So that's why it cannot be an independent basis for the final determination. That's why in order for this court to hold that the agreement or that the deadline is a standard to uphold or a basis to uphold the final determination, it would also have to agree with FMCSA about what the law required prior to September 2025.
And then there are all these, this refers to O, but that can't be the applicable date provision at 384.301A, O, and
yes.
O has a date. It's come into compliance as soon as practicable, but unless otherwise specifically provided in this part, not later than November 18th, 2024.
So it's I believe O, and I'll open the regulation just to make sure.
This is addendum 71. It must be you.
The reason for O, Your Honor, is because subsection A discusses part 384 of the federal regulations, and subpart O creates an additional requirement to come into compliance with part 383. So substantial compliance is a little bit of both. It is part 383 and subpart B of part 384. But in any case, the requirement to adhere to a corrective schedule is a procedural requirement under subpart C. It is not a substantive basis for a finding of substantial noncompliance. And I also want to mention something else that my colleague referenced was that the final determination should be upheld based on violations of any law. And we really want to fundamentally disagree with that. It can only be based on violations of federal law. It is true that DMV agreed that those licenses had incorrect expiration dates under state law, but FMCSA does not have overarching authority to enforce state law.
How would compliance with state law affects this situation of self-renewing permits? That is to say, there's only 2 years to run, but it's likely to be renewed automatically, or there's a year to run. But so under state law, what would you have to do? Issue it for only the 1 year that's present on the current document? You would.
Yes, correct, correct. Yes. Yeah, so
creating the problem you described of then having to bring people back in to renew.
Yes, exactly. So yes, that would be sort of inconvenient for the folks who were needing to come, as we described or as we discussed earlier, Judge Garcia. But so that is what was required. So absurd
that's required by state law.
I'm sorry?
It doesn't seem like quite as absurd since it's required by state law.
Well, whether it's absurd or not is frankly not at issue.
It's practical, let's say.
Sure. But as we discussed previously as well, states and state agencies have a lot of different factors to consider when they are going to decide what kinds of procedures and, you know, regulations they are going to enforce. And so for DMV, it made more sense administratively to have a law that required licenses to expire on the same date as the legal presence document. So, and that's, I don't think, problematic in this case. The fact is still that state law required one thing, and federal law only set a maximum ceiling within which states could regulate more restrictions if they so desired, as California did here. So if FMCSA is not correct about what the law says, then a violation of some other law other than the federal regulations under Part 383 and 384, subpart B, those are the only bases. Those are the only violations that can actually support and sustain a final determination. So finally, I also want to emphasize what we talked about earlier today, and that I think my colleague disagreed with, which is that if there was an agreement in the record, the agreement was only to cancel and reissue those licenses per FMCSA's instructions. And there are a few citations I can provide for that on JA018, as we discussed earlier, JA044, and on JA068 as well. JA068 is interesting because that is the December 16th email in which DMV responds to FMCSA's instruction, contrary instruction, to stop issuing or to not issue those licenses. I heard my friend say, if that was such an issue, why didn't DMV raise it? Well, we did on JA068. DMV is confused by FMCSA's new instruction to not issue licenses. And so it says, I want to be clear. Aren't we supposed to reissue these licenses? In fact, FMCSA, when it instructed DMV not to reissue, said, before you can resume your non-domicile program, we're going to need to review specific instances of corrected licenses. So DMV says, that means we're supposed to correct these licenses, right? And FMCSA says, no. So
this is the email from Steve at the top of the page.
Correct, yes.
Corrective action identified is void or rescind and reissue. Advise if you have a different understanding. And then Scott says, yeah, we do have a different understanding.
Correct, exactly, yes. And that's what sets off all of this discussion between December 16th and December 30th, that, again, we would say DMV did not unilaterally turn around and change this cancellation date. It was based off of, you know, extensive discussions in those periods trying to find a resolution given this new instruction not to reissue.
Anything? I actually, thank you.
Sure.
I wonder if we could hear briefly from Mr. Jerome about this subpart B point that that Ms. Keto has made.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Just if you had anything further to say about whether a failure to adhere to an agreed schedule is something that's only part of the process as outlined in subpart C and therefore not a valid ground under the regulations for a funding withdrawal.
Yes, Your Honor. So I see the reference in 384.307 to appear in subsection B under the preliminary determination. And so I think the regulation contemplates that this process will begin with a violation of federal law. In the final determination, subsection D, the state will take into consideration the corrective action either implemented or planned to be implemented with the mutually agreed upon schedule. This is something of an odd circumstance, I think. I think the regulation is clearly written in such a way where if there's an agreement to correct a problem, it is probably the case that the state has agreed that it is also a problem, that it's something it needs to do. But, you know, I think if there were doubt about why FMCSA has authority to impose the penalty, that doubt is resolved by 384.307D, which refers specifically to the mutually agreed schedule.
All right. And if the state is, this is a separate question, if the state is not issuing licenses in a way that the, like in the old days before there was much attention to the mismatch of the dates, how would the federal government enforce its interest in having CDLs only held and used by people who had valid work authorization? Presumably some of those drivers are employed by larger companies who have an independent obligation to check work authorization. But I understand a lot of commercial drivers are also independent contractors. So how does, apart from the kind of cooperative federalism that is manifest here, how does the federal government go about enforcing the work authorization requirement?
I'm sorry, insofar as it's effectuated through the CDL scheme or more generally, how does the federal government?
Insofar as it's effectuated with respect to CDLs.
The most obvious answer, Your Honor, is that there are roadside inspections that take place. And so often they take place through state partners, but they are under the aegis of the federal agency. This sort of reinforces the importance of having credentials that are valid and, you know, reflect the correct expiration date, to a point Judge Ginsburg made with my colleague about the proposed fix, is that we'll fix it all on the back end, but the cards out in the real world won't reflect the correct expiration date. Not only is that bad for the driver, as was the premise of your question, Judge Ginsburg, but also, you know, these individuals are pulled over for inspection by police in a number of other circumstances. And so the importance of the actual credential. Anyway, but
presumably that they'd also have access to CIDLIS, and that's where the back end fix could show up.
I think that's right, Your Honor. But if anything, I mean, that it's sort of time consuming. It would raise a question. Well, why does your license say it expire? Why is it, you know, CIDLIS says something totally different. But that is the most obvious answer, that apart from the point of issuance, that there are these routine inspections on the side of highways.
There's one final question. It's about this pause issue.
Please.
That I think at least I'm struggling with. I believe you said, you know, we haven't really issued an enforceable order that they must pause. Assume that's true. I'm not going to treat that as a concession. If that was true, what should we say about the pause in this opinion?
You know, I think the sort of cleanest answer is that a pause is a corrective action, that when there's been a determination that there's a violation, that that FMCSA can say, here's one aspect of the remedial process we expect you to undertake that fits under 384.307.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.